This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
President of the United States and more of his White House staff have coronavirus just weeks before the big election. The reality of medical science has finally breached the last bastion of deadly denial. Meanwhile, lost in that shocking news, government money propping up the U.S. airline industry ended. Between 30 and 50,000 more airline employees get laid off. The international airline industry is collapsing, which is good news for emissions to the atmosphere, but terrible news for millions upon millions of poorer people who depend on tourism around the world. Maybe the next planes up will be electric. Despite what you see in the stock market so far, major parts of the economy in most developed countries are collapsing. A member of my family just lost his job, while literally millions of people are looking for work that isn't there. Evictions are beginning during the worst pandemic in over 100 years. In my opinion, no matter what happens politically, we're entering a period of financial panic in the developed world, and as the United Nations warns, mass hunger to starvation for hundreds of millions of people in developing countries. So why would you listen to a couple of scientists talk about climate change on Radio EcoShock? That is another harsh reality we have denied too long. Climate change will rock this world more than COVID-19. One of our guests, part of an elite group of German researchers, sticks to her prediction. On our current course, we're heading to almost 6 degrees centigrade of warming by the year 2100. That will drive sea levels up 2.5 meters or 8 feet. And that is just the start of coastlines changing and flooded cities for centuries to come. If we cannot slash our greenhouse gas emissions, we are talking about global catastrophe for everyone and all species. That has already started, whether Trump wants to admit it or not. Our second guest from Switzerland describes one of the most elusive problems of the climate change in coming times, marine heat waves. The U.S. West Coast already experienced this during the blob of hot water hovering off Washington, Oregon, and California for almost 2 years, while wildfires burned on land. Now it's back, and may keep coming back more and more often until that hot ocean becomes the new normal. Remember when the TV weatherman says the hurricane will strengthen as it crosses the hot Gulf of Mexico? That is what marine heat waves do. When coral in Australia's Great Barrier Reef went dead white in recent years, those were marine heat waves. A marine heat killed off the lobster fishery off the east coast a few years ago. It slowly returned a bit. Hot ocean conditions that might have come once every 1,000 years are coming every 10 years or less, and they may come every year, becoming, as I say, the new normal. All this, the sea level rise, the heat, strange storms bringing a month of rain in a day, drought and food failures, these are climate-driven events, and they will not appear magically in the year 2100. They're hitting us now with punches that will just get harder as we all get older. This is science we cannot ignore even in the most tumultuous times. As Kevin Trenberth said on Radio EcoShock last week, there is no vaccine for climate change. Here is where we are. If humans can make wrenching changes to our daily lives and our future plans, we can avoid utter catastrophe from a rapid climate shift. We are already committed to climate disasters. Disaster is the best-case scenario now, that's the truth. Catastrophe is what we must avoid, and I believe we can. So yeah, let's take time to listen to a couple of scientists you never heard of, as they lay out more of the greatest threat in human history. From the Potsdam Institute for Climate Impact Research, we have new science with Professor Ricarda Winkelmann. Then from the University of Bern, Switzerland, a new understanding of marine heat waves with Dr. Christine Lofcotter. Thank you for tuning in. I'm Alex Smith, blasting out on more than 100 nonprofit radio stations in many countries and online throughout the world. You have joined Radio EcoShock.
covering the world. This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Authoritative science warns, once we pass thresholds of warming, we may never go back to the state of frozen poles known throughout human history. Even if we meet the best internationally agreed goals with drastic reductions of greenhouse gases, Antarctica will still lose enough ice to push up sea levels by at least 2.5 meters, over 8 feet of sea level rise, flooding deltas and port cities around the world. A new paper published in the journal Nature tackles this head-on. Our guide is co-author Ricardo Winkelmann, professor of climate system analysis at the Potsdam Institute for Climate Impact Research, known as PIC. Ricardo served science on two research expeditions to Antarctica, helped develop ice sheet models, and contributed to the latest report on sea level change by the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. From Potsdam, Germany, Ricardo Winkelmann, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thanks for having me.
Scientists from the Potsdam Institute have pointed to two fundamental types of climate tipping points. Can you outline those two types for us?
Yeah, so when it comes to Antarctica and also the Greenland ice sheet, they're both considered tipping elements in the climate system. And the reason for this is that we have internal dynamics that basically lead to self-reinforcing processes within the ice. Let me give you an example first from the Greenland ice sheet. This is a process or a mechanism that we know really well from mountain hiking. So if we hike down from the peak of a mountain to the valley, then it gets warmer around us, so temperatures just rise as we're hiking down the mountain. And the same is true for the ice sheets. That means if we have enough melting at the ice sheet surface so that the surface drops to lower levels, then that means the temperature at the ice sheet surface is raised, and thereby that can lead to more melting at the ice sheet surface, and so on and so on. So this is what we would call a self-reinforcing or accelerating feedback in the ice sheets.
And the first word in the title of your new paper may throw some people off. It will be foreign to most listeners. But Ricardo, how would you explain the word hysteresis to the average person?
So hysteresis is a well-known but rather complex physical phenomenon. We know this also from other physical phenomena, for instance, from ferromagnetism. And it just refers to, well, a past dependency, if you will. So in our case, this translates into irreversibility. And what this means is if we warm the planet further to a certain critical temperature threshold and part of the Antarctic ice sheet is lost, and we then reverse that temperature forcing, meaning we cool down the planet again, then we would actually have to cool down the planet by way more than to present-day temperatures to regain that ice volume.
Yes, one example that I finally understood this term with is that once Greenland, for example, is determined and in the process of melting, it would not be changed just because we rearranged our greenhouse gas emissions. It might even take another ice age to return Greenland to the way it was.
Yeah, and especially for Greenland and for Antarctica, this is really pronounced. So we actually have several of these internal tipping points in the ice sheets, and that leads to irreversibility for both ice sheets when it comes to continued global warming.
Ricardo, how does the threat of sea level rise from Antarctica compare to Greenland?
So if we just compare the sheer ice volume, I mean, both of these are giant ice sheets, but if we take Greenland and we were to melt it down completely and distribute that meltwater over the oceans, then this would raise global sea level by roughly 7 meters. Now, for Antarctica, it's actually 58 meters of sea level equivalent that is stored in the ice sheet. And yeah, this is really a number that's almost hard to assess, and therefore melting from the Antarctic ice sheet would really change our coastlines around the world.
So for our North American listeners, that's over 160 feet of sea level rise, if it all melts. But that would take thousands and thousands of years if it were to happen at all.
Exactly. So what we're looking at in our study is sort of the long-term stability of the West and the East Antarctic ice sheet. So really the question, how much warming can the ice sheet survive on the long term? And we did this with means of a numerical ice sheet model. So in roughly 1 million hours of simulation time, we looked at this for different model configurations so that we could really ascertain the risk and also the uncertainties that come with this kind of sea level rise.
This new paper, it's led by Julius Garb. I hope I pronounced his name correctly, and co-authors with people I know, like Radio EcoShock guest Anders Leverman. And in it, we find a scale that estimates sea level rise from Antarctic melt, but that scale doesn't go up neatly with each degree of warming. It appears to jump or respond in steps when certain temperatures are reached. Is that correct?
Exactly, and that exactly has to do with those tipping points in the ice sheet. So because we have these strongly nonlinear self-reinforcing feedbacks, such as the melt elevation feedback I described earlier, there are several others of these, that leads to really these jumps in the sea level curve as we look at it as a function of temperature. So it really matters if the planet warms by, say, another degree or another 2 degrees, because we might cross such a tipping threshold.
And let's pretend all the nations act to achieve their climate commitments in the Paris Accord of 2015, and maybe a technology to remove some carbon from the atmosphere goes mainstream by 2050. Miraculously, we hold warming to 2 degrees C above pre-industrial levels. Would that halt the great melting on Antarctica and prevent disasters from rising seas?
Well, even if the Paris climate goals are met, then on the long term, we could, looking at sea level rise of roughly 2.5 meters is what we find in our study. Now, this would not happen overnight, but it's certainly something that we need to keep in mind, because even though the sea level rise is happening over longer time scales, it is actually our decisions now and in the next couple of years in terms of greenhouse gas emissions that leads to this committed sea level rise. So even though this whole process of sea level rise and ice loss might take longer, it is our actions and our decisions now that decide the fate of the Antarctic ice sheet on the long run.
Yes, well, I'm curious in how long that time lag is. I mean, it's key to know, does your work suggest severe rising sea levels would take so long that humans could withdraw from the coast and perhaps rebuild a new civilization? What do you think?
So we're specifically not looking at the timescales of the melting here, and that has to do with our approach of really looking into the long-term stability. But what we can say is that even once a threshold is crossed, it matters very much by which rate of temperature rise we're looking at. And that will decide also the rate of sea level rise that comes from this.
Why do you and your colleagues say the ice sheet on West Antarctica is, quote, committed to long-term partial collapse?
So the West Antarctic ice sheet is what we would call a marine ice sheet. So it's based below sea level. For ice sheets that are marine-based, we have something called the marine ice sheet instability. So that's another one of these positive or self-reinforcing feedback mechanisms in the ice. And most of the West Antarctic ice sheet is actually subject to this potential instability mechanism. And we already see some of that at play in parts of the West Antarctic ice sheet in the Amundsen Basin. So this is why the West Antarctic ice sheet is particularly vulnerable to increasing temperatures and especially also to changing boundary conditions in the ocean. So ocean warming could actually lead to this kind of instability mechanism in the West Antarctic ice sheet.
And outside West Antarctica, a couple of years ago, NASA announced the massive Thwaites Glacier will flow into the sea and is now unstoppable due to the rock formations underneath it. There's nothing to prevent it from keeping on going. Is that part of the polar tipping points that you were investigating?
Exactly. Thwaites Glacier as well as Pine Island Glacier are part of the Amazon region in West Antarctica, where some of these mechanisms are already at play.
In a 2015 Radio EcoShock show, I actually played a clip of you from your presentation at a conference called Our Common Future Under Climate Change. It was held at UNESCO headquarters in Paris in October 2015. I believe you said that on our current course, we are headed towards a world 5.8 degrees C hotter by the year 2100. Ricardo, do you still think we are heading towards such catastrophic warming?
So all the scenarios actually show that we're right now, on our current course, we're still tracing sort of the upper scenarios put forward by the IPCC, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. That means that with the emissions, if we continue in a business as usual scenario, then we're tracing that upper temperature scenario, and that could lead to more than 4 degrees of warming within this century.
And suppose we go to 6 degrees C of warming. According to your new research, what happens to the Antarctic ice sheet?
With progressing warming, we see that more and more parts of the Antarctic ice sheet are subject to ice loss and could potentially become unstable. And at 6 degrees of warming, we see that next to the marine ice sheet instability, which is mainly driven by changes in the ocean, we also have the processes at the surface that play a dominant role. And this leads to another major threshold in the sea level curve for Antarctica. So on the long run, 6 degree warming could actually lead to almost 12 meters of sea level rise if these warming levels are sustained.
Which is close to 40 feet. Now, Ricardo, did you manage to figure out how much warming it would take to guarantee Antarctica would emerge virtually ice-free?
Yes, we did. So we continued these kinds of simulations until we could see what it would need for Antarctica to become virtually ice-free. Now, we have to keep in mind that Antarctica has existed for more than 34 million years. So this is really sort of our ultimate heritage from earlier ages. And with more than 10 degrees of warming, we could actually lose the entire Antarctic ice sheet on the long run.
On the other hand, if we get carbon capture technology or we block the sun somehow, how much would we have to cool the planet to get ice returning to the West Antarctic Peninsula?
So once parts of the Antarctic ice sheet are lost, it's hard to get them back. And this is exactly what our study shows, that some of these changes are virtually irreversible. So that means that we would have to cool down the planet to more than pre-industrial temperature levels to actually regain that ice volume from Antarctica.
And suppose we go to 3 degrees C of warming, which I'm hoping is the most realistic vision at this time. If we get 2 or 3 meters of sea level rise from Antarctica, that doesn't happen magically in the year 2100 at the same time as the temperature goes up. Do we know how long it is delayed, or did you say earlier you didn't work on the delay factor yet?
We didn't explicitly look at the time scales. What we know is that even if we were able to cap global warming at present day levels, so if we stopped emissions right now and we also kept the temperature levels at present day level, then sea level would still continue to rise after 2100. The bulk of sea level rise actually happens with some time delay, and this is why sea levels would continue to rise beyond 2100, even if we were to stop global warming right now.
I'd like to look for a minute at the effect of meltwater from all this. In an earlier work, Dr. James Hansen worried about the high impact of meltwater entering the North Atlantic Ocean from Greenland. There is already an abnormally cold blob of water south of Greenland. Some projections wonder if this will cool the UK and Northern Europe even while the rest of the planet heats up. Has there been research into the ramifications of introducing so much Antarctic meltwater into the Southern Ocean?
So this is still a subject of investigation, but what we can say is that it would certainly have an effect on the overall ocean circulation. Just as for Greenland, Antarctica plays an important role in that ocean circulation as well. And for Greenland, the story is really clear that if we have more meltwater from the Greenland ice sheet, then that can actually lead to a slowing of the Atlantic ocean circulation, which in turn affects our weather in Europe and also in Northern America. Now, for Antarctica, it plays a really important role in the formation of Antarctic bottom water, and that in turn also influences the global ocean circulation. What we have to keep in mind is that the ocean circulation plays a major role also in determining our weather patterns, and that is because it's the most effective heat transport system that we have on planet Earth.
In 2012, you led a paper with Anders Leverman suggesting sea level rise from Antarctica might be mitigated by projections of higher snowfall there, which would return some water to the continent. With 8 years more research and modeling, what do you think now?
Well, for a long time, there was this hope that because of warming temperatures, the air could also hold more moisture, and that in turn would lead to more snowfall, which could then lead to, a mitigating effect on sea level rise. And the first part of this, it still holds. So as the air gets warmer, it can hold more moisture, and that can lead to more snowfall for Antarctica. And this is also an effect that is present in our study here on the stability of the Antarctic ice sheet. But what we have to keep in mind is that this additional snowfall will also lead to more ice flow into the ocean. And there's a simple dynamic effect that can explain this that has to do with the position of the so-called grounding line, the separation between the grounded part of the ice sheet and the floating ice shelves. And this effect is really easily explained and can be derived analytically. We also see it in our ice sheet models. And that's the reason why a large part of this additional snowfall is immediately counteracted by the faster flow of ice into the ocean. And therefore, this initial hope that increased snowfall over Antarctica could potentially mitigate some of the sea level rise, unfortunately, does not hold.
Yes, it's interesting to know that it is the mass of the glacier that drives it forward. If there isn't enough mass, it becomes dead. It doesn't move anymore.
Exactly. So what is driving the flow of ice overall, that is the mass or the weight of the ice. And we have to keep in mind that in Antarctica and large parts of it, we have an ice thickness of more than 3 or 4 kilometers. So this is really a massive amount of ice that sits there on top of the southern continent. And that essentially, through gravity, drives the ice to flow from the interior of the ice sheet towards the ocean.
Now, another concept, in common wisdom, we acknowledge there are forks in the road. It happens in our life. You make one choice or the other, and then you really can't go back. Scientists call it bifurcation, I believe. How does that play out in the ice time that you study in Antarctica?
Yeah, bifurcation is sort of the mathematical description of what happens when we have these self-reinforcing feedbacks or tipping points in parts of the climate system. And Antarctica is only one example for such tipping elements in the climate system. The Greenland ice sheet is another one, and also the Atlantic overturning circulation is another example for such a tipping element. And if we have these self-reinforcing feedbacks, then that also introduces the notion of bifurcation. So basically, the path dependency means that once we cross a critical, for instance, temperature threshold, then it's really hard to go back.
You are listening to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. Our guest is Ricardo Winkelmann, professor at the Potsdam Institute for Climate Impact Research. We're talking about new science about Antarctica and sea level rise. Ricardo, is it fair to say we are only now discovering the physics of polar ice responding to global warming?
The physics actually hasn't changed. So we've known about some of these mechanisms at play in the Antarctic ice sheet for a really long time. For instance, the notion of the marine ice sheet instability that might be at play in the Western Antarctic ice sheet and also large parts of Eastern Antarctica, that is something that was put forward several decades ago. But what is new is that we, first of all, see this playing out right now under global warming. And secondly, that we can now pinpoint the tipping points for different parts of the Antarctic ice sheet and therefore sort of can do a stability check for the entire Antarctic ice sheet.
You also co-authored New Science out this year on worrying things like tipping cascades and the dynamic emergence of domino effects in systems. How should we understand these kind of harsh new looks at the way this planet really works?
So while we understand the physics of individual tipping elements and the climate system better and better, and we can learn more about the individual thresholds for each of these tipping elements, as, for instance, the Antarctic ice sheet or the Greenland ice sheet. One thing that we're researching now is how these tipping elements interact. And with this, we can imagine something like domino effects or tipping cascades. So if you imagine a set of dominoes, then the Greenland ice sheet or the Antarctic ice sheet would be equivalent to one of those dominoes. And this means that if you tip one of them over, it might potentially lead to other tipping elements to also get closer to their critical threshold. And this is what we're investigating in terms of tipping cascades.
It sounds like even if humans heroically change away from a civilization powered by fossil fuels, Antarctic ice sheets will still melt and flood coastlines around the world. The glaciers follow their own implacable laws. Why should we fight climate change if we've already lost such a crucial battle?
I would say it's more important than ever to fight climate change. And it is important that we reduce greenhouse gas emissions because every ton of greenhouse gases in the atmosphere matters. And this is exactly what we can learn from the tipping elements as the ice sheets, for instance, that it is important what amount of CO2 remains in the atmosphere and therefore also what kind of warming this leads to on the long term. And in the regard of the ice sheets, every tenth of a degree matters.
Please tell us about Antarctica in the Dominoes Project formed at the Potsdam Institute.
And the Dominoes Project is a project jointly by the Potsdam Institute for Climate Impact Research in Germany, as well as the GACES Institute. And here we're looking at interactions of tipping elements in the Earth system. And this includes both climate tipping elements, but also potential social tipping dynamics.
I think that's exciting work because there's very little known about social dynamics. But you're talking about when it comes to bringing the public into climate action, things like that?
For instance, so there are actually a number of studies out now that look at the idea of social tipping processes. And you can imagine this, again, as a set of dominoes. And I believe that in order to prevent some of these climate tipping points from being crossed, we need something like a social tipping process that could lead to, for instance, divestment from fossil fuels and therefore a reduction of greenhouse gas emissions.
And who funds the Potsdam Institute for Climate Impact Research?
The Potsdam Institute for Climate Impact Research is funded, first of all, by state funding, but then we also have a lot of third-party funding for our work.
That interests me because, you know, climate denial may be less in Germany, but it certainly rules at the moment in the USA, and it's running strongly in other countries, including Australia. And that's happening even while we have extreme heat, giant wildfires, the poles are melting back, as you and I are talking about, and still people are denying the science. Do you think we're ready to face the kinds of reality uncovered by science like yours?
I think we are ready, and I think it is now a matter of putting the measures that we know will have an effect on greenhouse gas emissions to work. I think our study really is another exclamation point behind the Paris Agreement on keeping global warming to well below 2 degrees.
As we finish up here, I wonder if our listeners want to discover more about how changes at the poles will affect our future. Are there any particular resources you would point them towards?
Well, first of all, I think the IPCC is a great resource, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, specifically also the summary for policymakers, a great summary on not just the science around Antarctica and Greenland, but also around climate change in general. And then, of course, we have a number of scientific papers that have also been beautifully summarized in some journal articles.
Well, I'm going to put links to some of the science that we've talked about today in my weekly show blog at ecoshock.org. And we have been exploring Antarctica in the age of climate change with Professor Ricardo Winkelmann from the Potsdam Institute for Climate Impact Research. Ricardo, we appreciate you sharing your valuable time with us.
Thank you so much. It was great talking to you.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
Record-breaking heat waves are not just striking land. Extended heat waves are appearing around the world in the ocean, with deadly consequences for everything from coral to fisheries. But are they caused by humans adding greenhouse gases to the atmosphere? Until now, we could not answer that question. We have a new paper in the journal Science, High-Impact Marine Heat Waves Attributable to Human-Induced Global Warming. And we have the lead author to explain it. Dr. Charlotte Lofcotter is a marine scientist at the Physics Institute of the University of Bern, Switzerland. From Bern, Charlotte Lofcotter, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Hi, thank you for having me.
I first got into marine heat waves as a critical issue during coral bleaching in Australia's Great Barrier Reef. That started around 2011. Many suspected global warming was driving those events when hot seas led to coral die-off. Why, until your work, was it hard to attribute those hot waters to climate change?
So one reason was certainly that the satellite record wasn't long enough at the time. Ocean surface temperature is measured by satellites since 1981, roughly. So when we started the study, there was about 36 years of satellite observations available. And you need a certain amount of time period of observations to establish what's normal. So then in comparison to that, you can define what is an extreme heat event. And as these heat events are very rare events, a shorter observed period would strongly increase the statistical uncertainties.
Okay, there were abnormal ocean temperatures around New England a few years ago, severely damaging the fishing industry there, lobsters in particular. Was that a marine heat wave?
It certainly sounds like it. It depends a bit on how exactly you define marine heat wave. There is currently no international consensus what exactly it is. In our study, we defined that all temperature anomalies above the 99th percentile are heat waves. A temperature anomaly is the difference between the observed temperature and the temperature that you would expect for that season and that time of the year. And above the 99th percentile means basically the 1% warmest temperature anomalies. Does that make sense?
It does. So time after time, I've seen meteorologists on TV saying a hurricane is gaining strength because the Gulf of Mexico is hotter than normal. They don't report on marine heat waves. Are those seaborne heat waves making hurricanes, typhoons, or cyclones more powerful?
In general, this might happen.
as you said, warm surface water is a favorable condition for hurricanes to form. But the opposite is also possible. When hurricanes travel along the ocean surface, they strongly mix the surface water with deeper, colder water from below. And so in this way, they can also interrupt a heat wave.
We seldom get an overview of where these hot spots are popping up. Charlotte, can you give us a list of major marine heat waves during the last 10 years?
Yes, I can list you the heat waves that we have analyzed in our paper, which are all very large heat waves of which the impacts were documented. In particular, this is the infamously called blob, the largest marine heat wave that has occurred during the satellite data in the Northeast Pacific between 2013 and 2015. Then there were three heat waves around Australia in 2011, 15, and 16. There is a big heat wave at the U.S. East Coast in 2012, and also we looked at two heat waves in the Southern Ocean and one in the Southwest Atlantic. However, I said yes-ish because these are not the 10 largest heat waves that have occurred in the last 10 years. And particularly, if heat waves occur in the open ocean without affecting the coastline of a specific country, then they are not given names and very little or nothing is known about the impacts.
I was going to ask you about that do they only happen right along the coasts and we all hear about them in the news, or are they happening, as you say, out in the Pacific Ocean or the Atlantic Ocean and nobody really knows much about them?
Yes, that's true. I've seen very large heat waves occurring in the open ocean without affecting any coastlines. And, yeah, I've also not seen any signs or media talking about these heat waves. But then if a heat wave occurs close to the coast, then, of course, the people who live there are usually strongly affected, and so then these heat waves are more well-known.
And how long do these heat waves in the ocean usually last?
That has changed a lot over the last decades. At the beginning of the satellite observations, so in the 1980s, a really long and large marine heat wave would last up to 50 days, and that would be a really extreme event. Globally, there were only about 30 heat waves of this size. But in the last 10 years, we have detected 172 heat waves, and several of those lasted longer than 100 days. So the length of the heat waves has strongly increased.
A new way to measure marine heat waves was just announced this year. Instead of simply taking measurements of surface temperatures, as I understand it, scientists now talk about thermal displacement. Can you help us understand what that means?
I can try. So many marine species respond to warming or to a heat wave by relocating to a more favorable area. And thermal displacement is a metric that describes how far they would have to travel to do that. So, for example, imagine you're a fish and you like water temperatures of about 27 degrees, and then a heat wave occurs. The thermal displacement would tell you how far you have to swim until you reach water with 27 degrees again. And depending on where you are in the world, this can vary by, it can be like 10 kilometers or it can be up to 1,000 kilometers. Is that understandable?
It is, although I have to say thermal displacement is so new to me that I didn't get it. I read through a couple of science papers, and it's difficult, I think, for the public to grab that one.
Yes, I agree, but I don't know how else to explain it. It just describes the distance you have to swim until you reach the original temperature again.
The temperature that you need to really survive. And for those species that can't move, I presume that they die off in great numbers.
Yes, that's true. It's very sad, actually. So particularly for those species that are attached to the ground, I'm talking about corals or seagrass or kelp forests, they cannot avoid the heat wave, and they are often very vulnerable and hit hard by this. So of the heat waves that were observed and of which we know the impacts, they had massive coral bleaching as a consequence, often local extinction of coral species. There was also a loss of seagrass. And in cases, it really takes years of an ecosystem to recover from that and get back to its normal state. I sometimes like to compare this with wildfires. So if there is a forest burning, then some organisms might actually be able to run or fly away. But then if they want to return, then there is no forest anymore to return to. So this can really be the end of an ecosystem, at least locally. Yes, okay, so we've also observed an increased mortality in seabirds, in fish, in invertebrates, and also in marine mammals. This is partly due to the heat stress just directly, but it's also sometimes caused because heat waves are often associated with very low ocean primary productivity. That means there is a very low food supply. So in addition to the heat, then there is also stress from no food. And then also heat waves have been associated with harmful algal blooms, which can be an additional stressor.
You talked about the famous blob that was off the western coast of Canada and the United States a few years ago. Well, in 2019, NOAA, the U.S. National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, reported that the blob was back. And they talked about a ridge of high pressure in their press release, quieting winds that usually mix and cool the ocean surface. They said it could, quote, go away pretty quickly if the unusually persistent weather patterns that caused it change. Are these abnormal hot patches in the ocean we are talking about caused by the weather? And how do marine heat waves end?
Sometimes they are, and sometimes they can have other drivers. I would say each heat wave has its own individual set of drivers. So the weather can certainly cause a heat wave either because the atmosphere itself is very warm, causing a strong heat flux into the surface ocean, or there can also be a change in cloud cover, which affects then the amount of sunlight that reaches the ocean. But, for instance, the heat wave around Tasmania in 2015, there was a paper showing that it has been mostly caused by heat advection within the ocean. So there were currents transporting warm water into that area, which was the driver for this heat wave. Marine heat waves have also been shown to be associated with large-scale climate oscillations, for instance, the El Niño-Southern Oscillation. That doesn't directly explain what the exact mechanism is that causes the heat wave, but we know that, for instance, during positive phases of El Niño, there are globally more heat waves occurring.
Well, that makes me wonder, is the famous El Niño itself, when the sea releases heat in the tropical Pacific, is that a marine heat wave, really?
According to our definition, with the warmest 1% of water temperatures being a heat wave, then strong El Niño years are effectively a marine heat wave.
So, Charlotte, when the seas cool back down to the temperatures we expect for that time and that place, does marine life just go back to the way it was?
That depends a lot on how long and how warm the heat wave actually was. So to a certain extent, marine organisms can survive a heat wave. If it's just a couple of days of unusually warm temperature, that's survivable. But as we said earlier, particularly organisms that are attached to the ground that cannot move away are often particularly vulnerable. And also, if heat wave causes local extinctions of, for instance, corals or kelp forests, then, as I mentioned earlier, there is not an habitat that you can return to if the warming is that severe.
So in 2019, a team of scientists led by N.J. Holbrook performed a global assessment of marine heat waves and their drivers. And the authors admit, quote, there is limited understanding of the physical processes that give rise to marine heat waves, end quote. In 2020, have we discovered how global warming creates this uneven distribution of heat in the sea? I mean, why not a general warming all over instead of patches of unusually hot seas springing up?
Yeah, I see why you would think that. So in general, the ocean is in its own a complicated systems of currents and water masses, and these currents are impacted and affected differently by global warming. So there are areas that receive more heat and warm up faster than others, and that would then next change the currents. They are affected by the warming, which would then again affect the warming in other regions of the Earth. So how exactly the ocean reorganizes to global warming is a very complex question. And I think that's also part of the reason why our understanding of the drivers of these heat waves is still quite limited.
Well, let's get to the specifics of your new paper, High Impact Marine Heat Waves Attributable to Human-Induced Global Warming, and that was published September 25th in the journal Science. How did you tackle the problem of connecting marine heat waves to climate change?
Okay, basically we have used model simulations to simulate two different worlds. The first one is the real world that we live in, including all the greenhouse gas emissions that have been emitted into the atmosphere since the industrialization. And the second world is an imaginary world where these greenhouse gases are missing. So it's the world how it would be without global warming. And in each of those two worlds, we've then calculated the probability that a heat wave that's as long or as intense as the observed one occurs. And then when we compare those two probabilities, we can say to what extent climate change can be attributable to the occurrence of this heat wave. And in our study, for several of these heat waves, this anthropogenic contribution was 100%, basically saying that this heat wave could not have occurred without global warming, at least not as long and as warm as it was.
Your paper compares marine heat waves now to their appearance hundreds or thousands of years ago before the new industrial climate. How do we know marine heat waves happened before we had modern science and reliable records?
We mostly rely on model simulations, so there is a certain amount of uncertainty tied to that. We also use estimates of how much the ocean has warmed since pre-industrial times. And there are actually some limited temperature measurements available from very much in the past, shipboard measurements. However, certain regions are much better covered than, for instance, others. The Southern Ocean, for instance, there is certainly a lot of uncertainty. But in regions where there was a lot of ship traffic, there we have a better understanding of how warm the ocean used to be.
The waters above eastern Siberia have been hot this year, as has the land there. Are you aware of marine heat waves in the Arctic Ocean?
Yes, I have definitely seen marine heat waves in the Arctic Ocean in the satellite record. I am not, however, aware of any study that describes the marine heat waves in terms of its impact or its drivers. And really, the seven heat waves that we look at in our paper are almost the only ones where we know about the impacts. So this is really a new field of science, and a lot is still there to be learned.
So we have the combination of hot seas offshore, and then we have, at the same time in Siberia, for example, hot weather plus fires onshore. And that leads me to wonder, are sea and shore heat both driven by persistent heat in the atmosphere, or can the hotter ocean be a driver for weather seen on the coast and beyond?
Yeah, it's an interesting question. I don't think this link is currently well understood. So the atmosphere definitely sometimes drives marine heat waves, but the other way around, I am not sure. There was data indicating that the blob has caused droughts over California, but I have to admit I say this with low confidence.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
You are listening to Dr. Charlotte Lofcotter on Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith, and we're talking about climate change and marine heat waves. When scientists discover warmer waters are undermining glaciers in Antarctica, should we presume the seas are only slightly warmer, but still frigid to us, of course, and so not really a marine heat wave? What qualifies as a marine heat wave? You talked about it a little bit earlier, but would it count for things like the Antarctic waters?
Yes. So we always define heat waves relative to the temperatures that you would expect in a certain region or a certain time of the year, similarly to how it's done on land. For instance, I currently live in Switzerland, and if there was temperatures of 40 degrees Celsius here, this would certainly be considered as a heat wave. But the same temperature would be normal in other parts of the world. So in those areas, it would not be a heat wave. And as you talked about Antarctica, a marine heat wave in Antarctica will probably have temperatures of only a few degrees above zero. But as we usually expect 0 or 1 degrees only, then it's still a 3 degrees temperature anomaly. So it would still count as a heat wave.
Are these heat waves getting transmitted to the colder waters further down in the sea, or are they mainly a surface water phenomenon?
From the heat waves that have been more extensively studied, we know that they can penetrate several hundreds of meters deep into the water column. But I don't know if this is true for all the heat waves that I saw on the satellite record. We can only say something about the heat waves where there were either shipboard measurements at the same time or Argo gliders independently measuring the temperature.
So in addition to the damage caused to plants, fish, and mammals, new science suggests that marine heat waves may also reduce the ocean's ability to capture and store our carbon emissions. In other words, heat in the ocean may lead to more global warming, a kind of feedback effect. Have you heard anything about that yourself?
In general, yes. The ocean's capability to take up carbon reduces with global warming. Carbon uptake is a complicated process, but among other things, it depends on temperature. Warmer water can take up less carbon. I don't know if marine heat waves, these are globally speaking quite rare events, and I don't know if they play an important role in this mechanism. I haven't seen a study specifically looking at heat waves and carbon uptake. It's possible, I suppose, but I would think that as they are rather rare events, the main driver of the carbon uptake is the general warming trend, not specific heat events.
That makes total sense. Now, science published last year by Li Jingcheng found the oceans on this planet are warming around 40% faster than the UN Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change report. Does the increasing rate of general ocean warming affect the chances of more marine heat waves happening around the world?
I have to admit that I actually looked up the paper, but I haven't really seen this 40% number. But anyway, in general, to your question, yes, if the ocean increases warmer, then there is also, or there should be a higher chance for marine heat waves to occur. Although I'm not sure if this is a deep ocean warming, then surface marine heat waves might be less affected. So it depends a bit on where exactly the warming occurs.
And Charlotte, is it possible for a marine heat wave to stick in one place for so many years that it could become the new normal state?
So currently, no. Currently, these are defined as extreme events. So if it was there currently forever, it would be normal. But yes, if global warming is strong enough in the future, then at some point the average temperature would be above the threshold that we use to define a marine heat wave. So in that case, yes, the ocean would be in a continuous heat wave state, and you might call this the new normal.
I'm hoping that doesn't happen with the blob off the coast where I live, but we don't know yet. So what does your new paper in Science predict for marine heat waves if we manage to keep warming at down to 1.5 degrees C compared to the more likely outcome of 3 degrees C of warming by the year 2100?
So if we manage to keep warming at 1.5 degrees Celsius, then the heat waves that we have analyzed will become events that would happen every 10 to 100 years, depending on which heat wave, which is already something that worries me. But if we reach 3 degrees warming, they will all be either annual events, as you said, being a new normal, or at least occur once in every 10 years or so on average. And in that case, the ocean would be very different from what it is today, and many ecosystems where they cannot exist anymore in the way they do today, at least. Particularly warm water corals, I think, are very unlikely to survive even 2 degrees warming.
Yes, we talked with a coral expert, Charlie Veron from Australia, and he also had a bleak outlook for the possibility of corals surviving the kind of global warming that we're creating right now on the planet. Now, again, the Holbrook Global Review of Marine Heat Waves said this critical field of study is still in its infancy. What is the follow-up to the study you just published, and what critical questions remain?
So one area that's not well understood at the moment, I would say, is heat waves in the deep ocean, and I expect more research to be done in that field. And something that people here in Bern look at, particularly my co-authors, Jakob Zeichler and Thomas Fröhlicher, they are interested in so-called compound events. That means that there is a marine heat wave, and at the same time, there is also an extreme and an additional stressor. For instance, it could be a drop in pH, or it could be low oxygen or very low chlorophyll levels.
And those things can happen together?
They can happen at the same time together, yes, or they could happen in very close succession. And then in addition, I would also say that in general, the impacts and the drivers of heat waves are not well understood at the moment.
Yes, we'd like to know the mechanics of just how, all right, this happens and then that happens, and so now we maybe even could predict them.
That's a good point. I think there is work being done on at least on a short to medium time scale, let's say, like have a warning that in 6 months a heat wave might occur. But this is not something I know a lot about. I just know that people work on this.
As we finish up here, is there anything else you would like to tell our listeners?
Sure, yes. Thank you very much for listening. I hope it was interesting and that you learned something about marine heat waves. And I personally also really hope that together we will manage to fight climate change and preserve the oceans for future generations.
Yes, we should keep the oceans as they have been for many ages instead of this new version that we're developing. From the University of Bern in Switzerland, we have been speaking with Dr. Charlotte Lofkotter, marine researcher. You can find links to the science we discussed in my weekly show blog, published Wednesdays at ecoshock.org. Charlotte, thank you for sharing your time and your research.
Thank you very much for having me and for your interest.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. There is just time left for a couple of climate news tidbits. Naomi Klein and friends have released a new short animated film available for free on the net. Look for Message from the Future 2, The Years of Repair on YouTube. The Years of Repair, Message from the Future 2. During our interview with Ricardo Winkelmann, I raised a problem set out in an earlier talk with Dr. Kevin Trenberth of NCAR. A team of top climate scientists, including Trenberth, Michael Mann, and John Abram, but led by Chinese scientists, including Guanchan Li, just revealed the ocean is developing dangerous layers. The paper is titled Increasing Ocean Stratification Over the Past Half Century. The implications would take a whole science fiction novel to become real to all of us. But this is science and not fiction. I recall over 10 years ago, the British inventor and scientist Sir James Lovelock pointed to ocean stratification as one of the doom signals for this age of living things. If the ocean stops mixing properly, a lot of important stuff stops working. Ocean creatures from plankton to fish get less oxygen to live. The great overturning currents of the world can get weaker, which changes weather over Europe and around the world. Now we have proof stratification has begun with this new science. The only question in all this now is, are we going to push the natural world into a cataclysmic breakdown? Will we do it just to drive around in gas-guzzling cars or burn oil and do all the things we always do, instead of taking energy from the wind and sun? The virus has shown we can make fast changes if our survival depends on it. Our survival depends on mass changes to slash greenhouse gas emissions because mammals like ourselves cannot survive in an overheated greenhouse world. I'm counting on you to learn everything you can about this. It's time for all of us to go back to school. Follow climate change science like it is the biggest news of the day, because it is. If you enjoyed the interviews today, you can get a full book of interview transcripts about surviving the new age of extreme heat, and you get that at my website, ecoshock.org. ECO, shock like an electric shock, .org. My sincere thanks for spending this time with Radio EcoShock. Please join me again next week.